Call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. It is 3:07, February 24th. With us today, Representative Seaton, Representative Coghill, Representative Keller, and myself, Representative Herron. We're going to have an overview of telemedicine by Melody Price-Yance and Dr. Stuart Ferguson. And Melody is the Director of Behavioral Health at CIRC, and she leads the behavioral health staff. And before her appointment as director, Ms. Price-Yance served as a CIRC Acting Behavioral Health Division Director and prior to CIRC, she was an active duty soldier in the U.S. Army, stationed in Germany, Oklahoma, South Korea, has worked in healthcare management positions with government and private health organizations. Okay, and then Dr. Stuart Ferguson is the director of Alaska Federal Health Care Access Network in Anchorage and has over 20 years of experience of computer and research experience, and he is the founding member and past chairman of the board of Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center. Please join us at the table. There is no public testimony scheduled. The meeting is being teleconferenced. Please state your names and your titles and your affiliations for the record. Thank you.
Yes, I'm Melody Price-Yance. I'm the Division Director for Behavioral Health at Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
I'm Stuart Ferguson. I'm Director of Telehealth for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay. If you could please start with your presentation. Do you want to go through it, or do you want to have questions as it go along?
As we go along is fine.
Okay. All right. We'll occasionally interrupt you for questions then. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be here to present this here today. We're kind of excited about our telebehavioral health program at CIRC. We have been running the telebehavioral health since 2003. This is just kind of an overview we give for people that are outside of Alaska, just to give them a reminder of how large Alaska is. So telebehavioral health, really, we use it to provide psychiatric, mental health, and substance abuse treatment to services in our remote villages. It really comes in handy because many times it's difficult to bring our patients in to our villages, from the villages to see the psychiatrists. It's a hardship on them, and it's very expensive. It's not an internet connection. It's not a satellite or a broadcast service. We send a video signal over a dedicated phone line, and it's confidential and secure. Our mission at CIRC Telebehavioral Health is to expand the psychiatric and behavioral health services and related activities via live video conferencing to remote villages to provide high-quality behavioral health care. Our vision is to establish a virtual community mental health collaborative that is decentralized and distributed. Each site has equal opportunity to contribute to the other site's needs, working together as a team. We use cameras, video displays, microphones, and speakers. The cameras that we use are very similar to this. That is the main camera. The eye can follow around. It follows movement. You can have presets on the camera. We have a video display either through a television or a flat screen monitor. We, of course, audio components using microphones and speakers. We have add-on components that we've used from time to time. We can have a document camera that we use when we're training staff in the field. It's pretty exciting. We can also screen in, switch over to either a VCR or a DVD player, and an electronic whiteboard. It's kind of nice when you're instructing.
Melody, just for the record, we've been joined by Representative Assistant Representative Lynn, and for the two joining us, this is Melody Price-Yance and Dr. Stuart Ferguson, and during their presentation, you're free to interrupt and ask questions, and with that, we will go to Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Can you tell me what a document camera is?
We have a document camera. It's called an ELMO, where you can actually take this piece of paper and you place it under the screen, and the person on the receiving side will be able to look at this document, and you can read from it, and you can go over talking points. While you're, and like I said, it's very good in training the rural village staff.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. And the electronic whiteboard is very nice too. You know, it serves kind of like the old paper easels. It's just a dry erase board. So, for CERT, why do we have telebehavioral health? We have many remote rural areas where year-round access to our psychiatrists that are housed in both Juneau and Sitka is very prohibitive. It's a hardship for the patient to travel in. They have very limited access to psychiatry. That leaves those areas underserved, and they could be undiagnosed in those remote areas. If we do send a provider out to those areas, it's very costly. And even sending a provider out to those areas, the continuity of care is lacking. And of course, in our rural centers, staffing issues is a consideration.
Okay, Melody. For the record, we've been joined by Representative Holmes, and this is Melody Price Yonce, and this is Dr. Stuart Ferguson. And you can interrupt to ask questions during the presentation. And so at this break here, telepsychiatry, that's something that all of us are going to have to focus on because of all the things you've just said. But are the cameras capable now that we can use, where you can get a close enough look at the patient and you could, you know, read their face, read their emotion, read their eyes? I mean, is that something that we're there yet, or is that something coming?
No, that is something that it's there. It's real live. We can take the camera, the video camera, can really, the whole screen can be the face, and we're able to read emotions, and it's almost like being in the room.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Seaton.
So, you on the consulting end can zoom in and zoom out, or is that preset at the location?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yes, we can. It's both ways. We can actually set the camera to zoom in on us, or we can set it to zoom in on a room of people. If we just want that one-on-one, for example, just you and I sitting in a room together, we can have that effect as well.
Representative Lynn?
Well, I'm a little bit confused, Mike, because, you know, we have the camera here, and I have my own camera. We can zoom in and out. But now, excuse me, if you're doing that, sometimes my expression might be dependent on your expression. So am I seeing you as you're consulting with me, so we have this back and forth communication between faces, as it were? I can see where I could react to your body language, and you react to mine, and we both don't make notes or whatever.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn. Yes, and actually, it's two way. It's almost like we're in the room together. We can they are viewing us live, and we're able to see their reaction to us. Does that answer your question?
I think through the chair, I've been in. And conferences with some folks from time to time where we have a live conference and we see each other. You know, and I'm looking at them on the screen and they're looking at me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. You're good. Representative Sisna, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. So I've actually been, watching. Actually, it was Eastern Aleutians looking at a school board meeting where there were numerous communities on the screen, and when someone spoke, the speaker was suddenly that person's face was much larger, and then everybody else's face reduced. I also was in Naknekan and King Salmon, and they were showing the telepsychiatry. But what I didn't see there was whether or not it'd be possible to do like it was in Eastern Illusions, where you could maybe do group. I mean, is that ever a possibility in something like that? It would be useful, would it not?
Through the chair, Representative Sisman. Yes, it is. And in fact, search is, we're going to be expanding our telebehavioral health. We are in the beginning phase of designing an intensive outpatient treatment program where we can extend our services to provide substance abuse counseling to many village sites at the same time conducting a group. We're very excited about that. It's going to bring a new link to our services.
That's great.
Thank you. Any other? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you. And as the we do offer full psychiatric services. We can use this to discuss with our clients their medication refills. The individual will have the consultation with the licensed local clinicians. We do this to set up the mental health assessment and the evaluation and the triage. That means if a client is out in the village and we need to and they present to the local clinic, for example, and they're in crisis, we can actually do the mental health assessment and the evaluation right over the Polycom system. It's pretty exciting. And again, we use it for the mental health and substance abuse consultation, psychotherapy, prevention services. We use it for the staff for treatment team review and treatment plan on a consistent ongoing basis. Also, our staff, for example, we have 9 clinics where we have community family service workers. The rest of the state, I believe, calls them behavioral health aides. Our clinical supervisor is based in Sitka, and she's able to provide clinical supervision on a continuous basis using the Polycom.
Yes, Representative Seaton. Sorry, Melody. Sorry.
Melody, you said you could do psychotropic medication refills. Can a prescription be made through the telemedicine as well, or is it just a refill of a prescription that's already been prescribed by the physician on the other end?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, both.
Well, okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. And also, we do use the Polycom for the behavioral health education and training via distance learning. We're able to provide our line staff, our field staff, with continuing education. And this gives you just a visual of where we are linked in Southeast Alaska. You can see we've got the Polycom system set up in Haines, Klukwan. We have the capability in Skagway, here in Juneau, Hoonah, Cake, Petersburg, Wrangell, and all on down on Prince of Wales through the Alicia Roberts Medical Center, and even in the tiny little community of Heidelberg. We do have Polycom equipment there as well. And it's used quite frequently. This is kind of a really older graph, but it just gives you an idea of what the encounters were from the beginning, from the inception. And as of yesterday, we had 1,504 since 2003 encounters that we've been able to use the Polycom. And it's increasing. And it is designed to empower the remote communities. We provide the needed behavioral health services to our residents. We do enhance the provider skills for our village communities. And the hub is primarily really a resource center. The hub for us, of course, is Sitka. Some of our goals are, again, to increase access to behavioral health services, to empower our local providers, and certainly to decrease costs. We offer the trainings. We're able to conduct peer review the clinical supervision and consultation as well. Some of the other programs that we do, the grand rounds, the case conference, we have monthly seminars and regularly scheduled meetings.
Excuse me, Melody. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I know that a few years ago we passed provisions so that residential psychiatric or people being referred to API could take initial treatment or stay in local hospitals before going on and whether to stabilize or see if they could short circuit that process of sending someone to API. Does this serve some of that same function to catch crises early and keep people in their communities instead of shuttling them on to more intense services? I mean, has that been the effect of the Polycom usage?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yes, it is, and it is an effective method of keeping that individual in their village. If we can catch them at that crisis point, and that evaluation is done, and if we're able to stabilize them and keep them in the community, that of course is the ideal. But we are able to do that evaluation. There are some of our communities. If there is an urgent crisis, if the person is considering harm to themselves or harm to others, you know, that might be the time where we need to step in and look at a Title 47. And in that case, certainly not. That is a much higher level of crisis, and we would have to refer them on.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. But I was just wondering about the experience. I'm glad to know that's the intent. Has the experience been that it's been effective? Have we had fewer referrals directly to API or through the stopgap here at Bartlett, or has it been effective in reducing those crises that, you know, continue to foment and then have to go on? I'm just curious about the results, how it's worked as well.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I wish I had the numbers to support that. My instinct tells me yes, but I don't have the data, that type of data with me today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
Okay. And again, this just gives you an idea of what our virtual community looks like. It's decentralized and it's distributed. It's really pretty exciting, and it's really exciting to see all of our providers come together, and they do, from all of these communities on a regular basis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might ask, Mr. Chair, and thank you. The thing that I have heard in talking with providers oftentimes in rural communities is the real problem that they've had with being cut off from an extended support network, and they're in a community where they really can't share things. Does this kind of thing help providers do a better job, get away from some of the kind of emotional isolation that oftentimes people do find when they're in a situation away from their own support group?
Through the chair, Representative Cisna. Yes, and actually we have a virtual talking circle just to deal specifically with the vicarious trauma for all of our remote sites. We're very cognizant of that with our providers being out in remote locations, and they're dealing with issues and crises on a continuous basis. So it's part of our plan, and we do. The monthly meetings that I talk about, we also have a talking circle for our providers, and they respond to that very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. And just some tips for best practices in the video conferencing. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the eye contact and maintaining an appropriate camera position. And as Representative Cisna indicated, the camera can have presets where we can pull in a whole group of people, or we can focus on one person, and we can switch it back and forth. Or if we're doing a teaching, we can also bring the document camera in. We can flip back and forth to a video, etc. And of course, this is Alaska, and we do have to prepare for the worst. There are times when the Polycom system, through disconnect in the satellite or what have you, some type of technical difficulty, will have to switch to a teleconference if the Polycom is not running. But that is rare, and we do have a backup plan available for, especially if there's going to be a one-on-one session with a psychiatrist or a therapy session. And just a little bit of information about our staff. At CERT, Dr. Rand West is the clinical director, and he is over the telebehavioral health system. He is actually on vacation and asked me to
smart man.
So that tells you a little bit about CERT and telebehavioral health. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions for? Yes, Representative Coggio.
First, my apologies for having to step out. I had a meeting that went right through the lunch hour. Mm-hmm. And I was going to faint on you.
Glad you didn't.
How's our dedicated lines doing in the areas that you have to serve? Do we have good infrastructure to help you? Tell me the health of that particular part.
Through the chair, Representative Cahill. We have T1 lines in all of our locations. We have excellent support, and I understand we're building capacity. That has not been an issue.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. Please go ahead.
Done.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to speak here. I thank Representative Keller for inviting us, and Representative Cisna has been to our office in the past as well, and it's nice to get a chance to share some of our experiences with you. I'm going to do a very quick demonstration just to give you a sense of how our system works in rural Alaska. What Melody presented from CERT is a kind of telehealth that involves live video and broadband connectivity, and CERT really have been the statewide leaders in pioneering that and have been doing it for quite a while. The rest of the state is now doing a lot more of that as well. The system I'm going to show you today is a parallel system. It's more like an email kind of based system where you can package data and move it, and it's appropriate for certain clinical care where live video is appropriate for other forms of clinical care. So I'll give you a very quick demonstration, and then I'll go to the presentation. If you were sitting out in a remote site and had a patient that needed to be seen by a specialist in Anchorage or lower 48, or these systems are now in Greenland, if you need to see a physician in Nuuk or in Copenhagen, you would fire up the system, you log in. I hope this connects me. And you would be able to use our system. It's designed using fifth grade language, which makes it easier for us to translate into foreign languages. Now, these buttons are not available right now because due to security rules, I can't connect this laptop to the internet. So this shows you what happens if you're in a village and the lines that we were just talking about, Representative Coghill mentioned, are down or disconnected or for whatever reason. You can still, while the patient's there, create a case. We would create a real case, and we'd use real information. I could go in and identify the patient. And because I'm not connected to a server, I can't pull up an old patient. So I have to kind of start from scratch. I'll do this very quickly.
So which one of us is the patient?
Well,
which one needs mental health?
Not an old one. That wouldn't be me.
I'm actually going to use Representative Keller.
Hey, all right.
He was born in January 1st, 19... I've got to be careful.
1960.
He's a male, and we'll skip all the other information. So we require basic information, and the reason we ask for instance, like date of birth, is because some of these devices will give you responses that depend on the date of birth. So let me give you an example here. This is an EKG. This is the entire EKG right here. And then these would be the leads that you would attach to the patient. So it's a small little portable EKG. And when we actually go in here, because we know that Representative Keller is 49, it knows his age.
Feeling a lot better now.
All of a sudden, you're feeling
better. By me, I'm 76.
Wes, you're supposed to go out there so he can put the leads on you.
Yeah. Give me a second. And like all good demonstrations, of course, this is going to fail. I may have some issues trying to run PowerPoint at the same time. Let me just... Well, let's kill the demonstration real quick, and I'll come back at the... I'm not sure why that's not failing.
Yeah. Wes,
yes.
You got no pulse.
You know,
no waves.
Not feeling better all of a sudden.
Okay.
Well, Doctor, we'll just do a little bit of housekeeping while you're getting
set up. Sure, let me get it set up because we're trying to do two things at once.
All right, yeah, we'll just take a break here. I passed out a flyer to you. It's with the Key campaign. And I guess that the co-chairs are going to ask a favor of members of the committee is that the House and Senate Health and Social Service Committees are hosting the dinner tonight. And as it turns out, both of us have prior engagements. And so we're asking members of the committee if anyone would be interested in going in our place and representing the House HES committee. So if you can, we'd much appreciate it.
Mr. Speaker, I was planning on going from 6 to 7. But that's short of the, maybe even the, well, it's short of the ending part, which is the neatest part on that Key campaign.
Okay.
But,
well,
what do you think?
I would think they'd appreciate you coming anyway, but if there's anyone else who'd like to go in our stead, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
So.
I have an engagement till 6, but it's, but I can go and be there at 6.
Good.
All right. So. Everyone is welcome to go, but I appreciate you helping out the chairman. Okay. Thank you.
Our apologies on that, by the way. We didn't get the information until real late, and all of a sudden we realized we were hosting.
Thank you.
I'm going to hold off on the presentation. I'm not really sure what technical glitches I'm having here. It doesn't happen like this except when you're doing it in a live.
Oh, sure.
It's a rule.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna go straight to the outcomes at this point. As soon as this presentation starts, what am I going to show you today are some outcomes and some data from a 7-year analysis that we conducted on the system that we have running in Alaska called the AFCAN system. There are a lot of people that contributed to this, and their names are actually on here. Dr. John Kokesh is a physician, the head of the ENT department, Alaska Native Medical Center. Chris Patrikowski is our clinical director. Phil Hofstadter is an audiologist in Norton Sound that's contributed data, and Nathan Hoag is on our staff at AFCAN. When I use the word AFCAN, it's really referring to a project that started in about 10 years ago, and it was federally funded. It was designed to create telehealth solutions for the federal partners in Alaska, the tribal health system, the VA, Coast Guard, Army, Air Force, and the State of Alaska Public Health Nursing. We have about 248 sites throughout Alaska. We design the systems, we deploy them, we support them, we train folks to use them. And now we're installed outside of Alaska, and I'll talk about that towards the end. Maybe it's a little late in the game to describe telemedicine here, but really it's just the use of communications to provide health care. Telemedicine is really focusing on the clinical aspects. Telehealth is the more broader word that we use today, and that can involve health education as well as direct clinical intervention. So here's an example of our system. You could be out in a small village clinic. You can have one of our carts, but it can work just straight off a simple PC computer. You capture data and you send it, and then a consultant, say at the Alaska Native Medical Center, can view that on their laptop and provide a response. We really focused in Alaska.
Doctor, I have a question. Pillar.
Now, how much training do you have to do on the site for the people that are operating these things? Is that a problem? Do you have to have somebody who's certified in the remote location to run the equipment?
It's always best if we have an opportunity to train people to use this, to use the software, but more importantly, to use the medical devices to do good equipment management. All these devices are fairly straightforward, but an EKG, if you don't know how to place the electrodes, you can get a bad EKG if you don't know how to clean the tip. The way that we do that in Alaska is we do a train-the-trainer program. So we try to empower trainers at each of the organizations to then support the system within their organization.
Okay, thank you. I guess, Doctor, just to follow up, the question is that, you know, I've seen these literally in every village clinic that I've been in. Is how many are in the state?
We have, with 248 sites, we have about 400 carts deployed throughout Alaska. We originally budgeted for about 250, and then organizations have since bought more, and now we're up to 400. One of the things that makes Alaska different from its approach to telehealth is that we focus on primary care. Most of the lower 48 that implements telehealth looks primarily at specialty care, getting access to specialists. 75% of our cases in Alaska originate with health aides and finish with a family physician, so they're focused on primary care. We looked at ear disease and heart disease. That's where we started this program. We've since expanded to looking at respiratory issues with spirometry to measure lung function, vital signs monitors. We focus on trauma, skin, wound issues. That's fairly standard. That can be solved a lot of times with a digital camera. We're seeing more and more dental problems, which, of course, we knew existed, but with the capability to take images of gums throughout Alaska, we actually were able to help assist in dental care. And then pretty much anything else that you can use a camera for, we can actually participate in. That being said, 25% of our cases do reach specialists, and primarily the Alaska Native Medical Center. We started with one department there. That was the ear, nose, and throat ENT department. We have since expanded, and now I think about 18 departments now take one cases of some kind or another at the Alaska Native Medical Center. And this is probably, to me, one of the larger signs of growth within our system, because the consultants are the hardest, I think, to line up and to involve them in the delivery of care. This gives you a sense of the growth of the system.
Doctor,
would you explain that a little bit more? The consultants being the doctor in the urban area?
The doctors specifically, yes, sitting in Anchorage. It's not hard for us sometimes to talk to a health aide and recognize that they have a need and they want to use the technology. Usually they're really interested and excited. The hardest thing is that you're doing process reengineering. So when you go into a very busy clinical department, say a tertiary care facility, and suggest that now they're going to do something else, you really have to kind of find out how to fit that into their existing clinical workflow and demonstrate value. And I think, to me, that's the sign of success, is that we now have that many departments that have bought in and using the system. The growth of our system...
Representative Keller? Representative Coghill?
So is there a communication protocol that you set up? Is that you get the health aides and the whoever the doctor or consultant is going to have to be able to get to the same information rather rapidly quite often. So is that a systemic training issue that you have to have in the care center and at the remote center? Just give me just a little idea of how you have to go through the training on that.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Coghill. The cases that come to Anchorage will come from family physicians who would receive the data from a health aide typically. So most of the cases would start there, and they would communicate with their normal workflow. So we don't try to change the workflow so health aides go directly to specialists. In terms of structuring the data specific to the case that's being presented, we've actually learned over time that we need to create some structured data sets. So if you're sending in a dermatology case or a rash case, you need different data sets than if you're sending something to the cardiologist or some other specialty. So we actually create standardized forms and templates for them to fill in the relative information then they attach the images to go with that.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I think probably I'm interested in, and so is everybody else in the committee, and that is quick response action items. Trauma is going to be probably one of the issues that health aides are called upon, some of the hardest things they have to deal with. and yet they're going to be there and probably enough time for some early, you know, symptomatic issues. So I was just kind of curious if they have a systemic approach that they fall into that somebody else on the other end knows about.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. When a health aide is dealing with any of the issues, they typically have a protocol that they follow regardless of whether they had telehealth. Telehealth just gives them an additional tool, basically, to capture the data and send it. The one thing we've learned in those emergent situations, the system has to work, and it has to work very quickly and efficiently for them because they have very limited time and there's a lot going on. And so we've worked hard on that aspect of it. On our system, you walk up to it, and within three touches to the screen, you didn't see it today, you're into any of the devices, and you can capture the data and send it. The other part, though, is this is an asynchronous system. It's not live, so you don't have a doctor on the other end. So we do train people. If it's an urgent situation, you get on the phone and you tell somebody that the data is coming.
Okay, that was the connection I was looking for. Thank you.
Right. We don't have data from 2008 to display today because we actually pulled this data late in 2008. But you get a sense of the usage of the system. It has grown from 06 to 07. We had a big jump there. I'm very proud of this table because the majority of telehealth systems in the world, frankly, typically see a decline. And there's several reasons for that. But what happens are people, as they receive cases and they receive responses, there's an educational component. And they start to understand, okay, that is an infected eardrum or whatever. And so they don't need to do a consultation the next time on that disease state. So it's not uncommon to see usage drop. What we're finding with the growth of usage is it's sites that had previously low or no utilization now coming on board, is adding specialties, is adding equipment, is adding technology. It's a combination of a lot that goes on to grow this system. But the growth has been there through 07, and you can see the number of patients have also jumped. So in 07, we saw about 10,000 unique patients through about 12,000 telehealth cases. And I mentioned this at the beginning. There are two basic concepts with telehealth or telemedicine: the live video that Melody talked about in the store and forward system. It's not that one's old-fashioned or one's new-fashioned. They're just different ways to they're just different tools. For radiology, dermatology, those are typically done by store and forward. You capture the information, you send it. For mental health and behavioral health, live video. For cardiology, it can be both. It can be a live echo or it can be a stored EKG. So the trick with telehealth is finding the right tool for that specialty, not trying to force fit one tool to every specialty, as you would expect. This gives you an example. We always tend to think of the trauma case where you've got a wound and you need to know, what do I do to this patient? And that happens a lot in our system. But here's a good example. Young children that come into Anchorage and they get PE tubes. It's the most common form of surgery in the United States. They go back to the village and typically they're not seen again. But we now have validated this protocol. We do reverse telehealth. The specialists ask the health aide to help them deliver care by asking them to image the patients, send in, and they can determine if that patient needs follow-up. If you don't do this, you get recurring ear disease issues and tubes being placed multiple times. Here's a good example. The doctor was not trying to figure out what had happened here. Obviously, the lip has been bitten. They weren't going to fly that patient, and they just really need to do something fairly urgently, and the doctor had not stitched a lip together and had an ID who would just kind of sew it together. He sent the image in. The specialist actually said, no, you're going to do it wrong. Here, connect A to B, C to D, and cut out those little triangular areas so it closes together. So another good example. It's just a communication tool that people can exchange information. Well, let me give you an idea of how we can reduce the cost of healthcare with this system. In 2001, when Medicaid started to reimburse for telemedicine in Alaska, and it's actually one of the most generous states in terms of, in that regards, we did a very quick study, and we looked at the first 91 Medicaid patients for which claims were submitted. The claims totaled at about $7,000. Of those 91 patients, we found that 79 of those would not have traveled did not travel, sorry, because we used telehealth. In those cases, Medicaid would have paid for the patient travel, and that would have cost Medicaid $55,000. So it's a fairly simple kind of idea here that we save $55,000 by spending $7,000. So it's about an 8-to-1 multiplier in terms of travel saved for reimbursing the physician to provide care. Now, we've gone back and we've looked at data back to 2002. We've actually studied, I think, 13,000 telehealth cases to get this data here. We broke all the telehealth cases in Alaska into primary care, so they never went beyond a regional hospital, and specialty care, where they came all the way into tertiary care facility in Anchorage. The red line, which is specialty care, we find that about 75% to 80% of all cases that come into Anchorage prevent the patient having to travel. And that's expensive travel. That's into Anchorage. We find that about 20% of all primary care cases, the ones that go from the village to the region, prevent patient travel. I can't really explain why the difference, but that gives you a sense of just how we affect patient travel. When you put some dollars to this and put some numbers in there, I've got primary care and then the specialty consults here. If you look at, I've annualized that for 2007 and done a total. But if you look at the annual for 2007, and I'll see if I can get my mouse here. We don't have a laser here, do we? Oh, there we go. You can see that in 2007, the savings in primary care for 20% of our telehealth cases was about $800,000, just in pure airfare costs. But for the travel that was saved coming into Anchorage, it was about $2.75 million. And then when you sum it together, we're saving for those 3,800 patients that don't have to travel because of telehealth, we're saving about $3.5 million just purely in air flying costs. A true economic analysis would factor in lost productivity, lost work, because many of these are children traveling with a guardian or a parent, and all the additional costs, hotels, per diem. This is something that we have not had a chance to analyze yet, but it's a very important aspect of telehealth. We all think of telehealth as keeping the patient at home, but about 8% of our telehealth cases cause patient travel. We find something that causes that patient to have to travel to the next level of care. We're guessing that those are the cases where you save lives or you catch a disease state earlier. And you can see that, frankly, specialty consults and primary care, they jump all around and they're somewhat seasonal fluctuations. But on average, about 8% of all telehealth causes patients to travel. If we involve an EKG, so it's a heart patient, that jumps to 12% of those cases cause patients to travel. And this is just a quote from Captain Bill Sorrells from Elmendorf, who was at one of the villages, had a heart patient come in, did an EKG, and immediately had to transfer the patients. And they feel that by doing the EKG and getting the evidence to the doctor, they feel they saved his life. Let me talk about improving access. One of the things that we can do when we have a ubiquitous telehealth system as we do in Alaska, it's the same everywhere, the same hardware, the same software. We can travel mid-level providers, not expensive specialists, but mid-level providers to the village and screen all the patients that would normally be waiting to see a specialist. It's much cheaper, it happens in the patient's clinic, and we can really provide health care a little bit more dramatically, faster and cheaper. Here's an example. We have this program called the Traveling Audiology Program. We've seen about 1,500 patients with this by going to about 60 village clinics over the last 4 or 5 years. It's cost us about $141,000 to run the program. We've saved travel for about half of those patients, about 755. And that's only talking about travel safe for them to come to the region. We're not even talking about saving travel to Anchorage. These are patients that were waiting to see a specialist. So they're on the waiting list, so they would have seen a specialist. We estimate we saved about $333,000 in travel, and so, of course, the program has a net return on investment. This is what's interesting, though. We track the outcomes for every one of those patients, and we find that 27% of those patients that were waiting to see a specialist didn't need to see a specialist. We removed them off the waiting list in the village. That's a quarter of your patients. That's a quarter of the workload a specialist would have seen. Now, the nice thing is that frees up space for 27% more patients. So now we're seeing more patients because we use telehealth, and they weren't even telehealth patients to begin with. Mm-hmm. We find that 26%, second bar from the right, of those patients needed to be seen in Anchorage. They didn't need to be seen out at a field visit in a region. They needed surgery or an intervention in Anchorage. So that's 26% get directly referred. Well, between this 27 and 26%, that's about half the patients are waiting to be seen. Now you get the other 50%, and they can be seen at the regional clinic. So as a triage or a screening tool, telehealth can be extremely powerful, and you do it at a lower cost. You're using a mid-level provider. Now, I'm assuming in the state of Alaska, and I'm assuming that you're probably interested in how that affected the Medicaid population. Now, we saw 1,500 patients, and half of those, 50.3%, were Medicaid patients. So when I went back and looked at just the data for the Medicaid patients, we found that almost all of them, 646, would have traveled, and we avoided travel for those patients. Most of those, 533, were underage and would have required a parent or guardian. When we estimate the travel savings, it would have been $443 for each of those patients, cumulative, including parent guardian, to fly to the region, compared to about $100 per patient for the cost of running this program. So again, it's a multiplier. The other perspective is about a third of those, a higher percentage, were referred to Anchorage for surgery or testing. The other thing that we can do with telehealth, because it's an effective screening tool, is we can cut back on the backlog. We have patients out in the regions and some of the villages that are just waiting to see specialists and are not getting in to see them. In one of our organizations, we just looked last week, we have 300 ear patients that are in a backlog to see specialty clinic. And at the rate specialty clinic is provided, that will take about 9 to 12 months for those children to be seen. So, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but if I had a child with an ear disease, I don't like being told I have to wait 9 to 12 months. So we had an audiologist in Norton Sound, Phil Hofstetter, who took on the role of trying to do more and more telehealth and screen his patients. And then he went back and he looked, and he went back to 1991, and he looked at every patient that had been seen by an ENT doc in Norton Sound. You see about 300 a year. So he actually looked at, I think, if I estimate this right, about 4,500 patient records. And what he found was that the average patient before he implemented telemedicine was waiting a little over 4 months to be seen, an average of a four-month wait. Now, these clinics only happen every 3 months, so you're going to have patients that wait almost 3 months in a perfect system. But in a perfect system, the average would be about 1.5. You know, you have 3 months and you have 1 day, 1.5 months. What he found is in the 3 years after he implemented telemedicine, that dropped to 2.8 months, and then it dropped to 2 months. And I'm not showing it here, but the actual data for the last year we have it, he's down to a 1.5 month average wait. So he's down to about as good a system as he can get. Well, here's the other way to look at this data. How many of those patients are waiting an exorbitantly long time, more than 4 months, so 5 months or longer? 47% were waiting that long before telemedicine. Within the first 3 years of telemedicine, 8%, and now he's down to 3%. And you're always going to have patients that wait a long time. They get snowed in when the specialist is there, or they can't attend a clinic. That happens, but it shouldn't be 47% of your patients. Improving process. Now, this goes back to Representative Coghill's question about emergency cases and turnaround times. We were curious how fast specialists turn cases around. Does it sit on their desk for a week? Does it sit in their desk for 2 weeks, a month? A lot of lower 48 systems guarantee a five business day turnaround. We don't have those guarantees at the Oscanee Medical Center. There are no guarantees, but it's just really based on how they do care. So we looked at 4,500 consults over a 2 year span, and we looked at how long it took from when that case hit the Oscanee Medical Center on their server till they actually sent it back. What we found is that 65% of all telehealth cases over a 2 year span are turned around in the same business day. If they're in by noon, they're back by 5 p.m. Of those, half of those were completed in 60 minutes. So what we find is about a third of the cases coming to the Alaska Medical Center are turned around in 60 minutes, another third in the same day, and then the other third take longer. And of that third, about half are the next day, and then the half take longer. And that can be because we need more information or whatever. We would advocate that if we actually supported live video, which we do now at the Alaska Native Medical Center, it's very tough for us in 60 minutes to arrange for a specialist to be available in front of a television camera to talk to somebody in the village. But through this technology, with kind of an asynchronous ability for doctors to sit and respond to it, we can provide a fairly fast turnaround time. Now, this is a key question, and we get asked this a lot by consultants. Well, how long is going to take a lot of time? I don't know if I want to be involved. And it goes back to that question of convincing consultants to be involved in telehealth. So we did a study, and we looked at, I think in this case, about 8,500 cases, and we looked at how long it took a person to create a telehealth case versus how long it took a consultant to respond to the telehealth case. And it's all over the board. I mean, and we don't know what's going on. We don't know if a consultant opens up a case. It's like an email, and you go get a coffee, and you come back. I'm just counting from when he opens it till he sends it. So the statistics are very skewed. But if we use the median time, which is the point at which 50% took longer, 50% took less, we find that consultants are able to respond to cases in 6 minutes. That means a consultant can typically see 10 patients in an hour, but there's no way they would schedule 10 patients in an hour. So it's a very efficient way for a screening or a quick consult. And this shows actually at the Alaska Native Medical Center how that median time has dropped from almost 7 minutes in 2002 down to 5.5 minutes in 2006. So with experience and improved technologies, we get some efficiencies. This is the other problem we have, and it's you might call it a marketing issue. When we have a new specialist that says, I'm willing to take cases, how do you tell 248 sites that now he's open for business and to send them cases? It's a struggle. So we do that. That's part of what my office does. I have four nurses or advanced nurse practitioners that work with each of the regions. But we had a dermatologist that we felt was underutilized. He was only getting about 2.5 cases per month from four organizations. So we started a business here where we would actually fly him out to do a one-day training. We'd fly him out, he'd do a one-hour session, and I'd fly out one of my staff to tell people how to use a digital camera to take good dermatology pictures. So it's kind of, we piggybacked on each other. And we found that the first organization we sent him to, after 4 years of about 2.5 cases a month, for the next 18 months, they jumped to 8 cases a month. Doesn't sound like much, it's 5 cases a month, but 5 cases a month is 60 patients a year. We've now done this at four organizations, and I have data from 4 years before to 18 months after. So it's not kind of a one-time thing. This is a sustained thing. And we find that overall the average is we see 250 more patients a year because we sent a dermatologist out for four trips. There's no way he could see 250 patients in 4 days. So it's worth doing this. It costs us money, but it's about relationships and communication. We, in our software, ask questions to people that create cases as well as those that consult on cases. One of the questions that we ask is, did this help educate the patient? And we have about 2,500 responses. And people can say they disagree to they strongly agree. And we find that about 2/3 of the people believe that the system helps educate the patient. We find that 3 out of 4 providers creating cases believe this makes their job more fun. We find that 4 out of 5 believe it improves patient satisfaction. We find that about 5 of 6 believe it improves the quality of care, but the most heavily answered agreed question in our system, and it's almost 9 out of 10, believe it helps them communicate with a doctor. And that's what this is about. It's a communication tool, and it builds on relationships, as the last slide with the dermatologist shows. So here's where we're headed right now. We are we're continuing to try new things in Alaska. We're actually one of the worldwide leaders in terms of trying new systems. People come to us with their ideas. We have a system right now where we can actually image the retinas of diabetic patients, and from that we can find if patients are about to go blind or they need laser intervention. The problem is it's a $30,000 camera, and we can't stock one at every village clinic. The nice thing is it's a non-midriatic camera. You don't have to apply drops. So anybody can use this. Any trained technician can use this. You don't need a physician to go with it to apply drops. So my office, we have 2 trained people, and they went out. They were up in Barrow. Beginning in January, they saw 65 patients in 1 week. Then they were in Manilik the following week, saw 63 patients. And that's over 100 patients that were screened. And this takes place of an annual eye exam. And we know that 50% of these folks never get their annual eye exam, and it can lead to proliferative retinopathy. So this is a technology that we're trying to take into a traveling system to work in the Alaska environment. We're expanding our system right now. We're in about 10 states in the lower 48, and we're beginning to do an HIV/AIDS program that has the possibility of going nationally across the lower 48. And we believe there's a way to take mental health, as Melody talked about with video, and store and forward and use screening tools and forms to screen patients prior to having to establish a live video. So we're working on those issues. We're interfacing with electronic health record systems. That's a key, I think, to the success up here. And we're trying new care delivery models on an enterprise scale, as opposed to working with departments. We're now working with the Alaska Native Medical Center and trying to design a system where all consults into that facility will come through the AFCAN system with a standardized form and standardized workflows. So we move from the department concept to the institutional concept, and we'll be able to hopefully tell you in about 6 months or 12 months, how that is operating. I'm going to finish with kind of one key issue here, and that's reimbursement. Telehealth is truly a cycle. It, you know, when we started the AFCAN system, it was a four-year project. Well, you can't do a telehealth project. That's like saying I'm going to do a healthcare project, and then we're all going to let all the doctors go home. It's a cycle. It's a technology, and you pilot it. And once you incorporate it and it becomes clinical, you do business, you have to think about how you sustain it. And as you sustain it and invest cash into it, it can expand and it can do more. And we're trying to grow this system. Alaska has been very good about supporting the reimbursement model, and that's very good. There are a couple things I'd like to share with you in terms of how we think that's working. A, it's very good. We can't lose the Medicaid reimbursement. It's too valuable, and it's too well-tuned the way it works right now. The struggle that we have, though, is that telehealth relies on your standard in-person coding system. Is it an existing patient? Is it a new patient? Is it a consult? Is it an examination and management? Is it level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? And telehealth is a really focused way of looking at the patient. If you go in to see your doctor, the nurse will go through your entire body system. They'll check everything on you. They'll do vitals, eyes, ears, nose, throat. The doctor will come in, take some of that information, and then focus the exam. But they can bill at a higher level, a level 3 or a level 4 consult. In telehealth, we're typically capturing very focused information and sending it. And a lot of times, we don't have enough information to justify a high-level consult. So in a sense, it comes in at a very low level. 50% of everything billed at ANMC is a level 1 consult for telehealth, probably not for in-person. So it taxes the provider and they get a low-level consult. Perhaps what's more important is this telehealth system requires a large infusion in technology and connectivity and training and support, not in Anchorage, but at the far end. A doctor needs a laptop, but a health aide needs an otoscope and an EKG and all the other devices and the support that goes with it and the training. That's where the cost is in this system. But there is no reimbursement right now for the person that wants to create a telehealth case. The reimbursement is for the consultant that views the case. So it's something to think about as you start to grow the system. There are values to everybody involved in this, but the reimbursement is misaligned, I think, with that. This is my last slide before the thank you slide. I just wanted to kind of share with you that we've been developing the system in Alaska, and I think we've done a really good job of building a system that's robust. It works in the villages. The software is designed here in Alaska. The carts are designed and built in Alaska, and that's why they have that Made in Alaska logo on the side of them. We are now in the process of trying to sustain and support our system by sharing it with other organizations and selling it. So we now have deployed the systems to about a third of the villages in Greenland, and another third are going out next month. Schools in Ohio and Akron Children's Hospital are using this to take consults from school nurses. It's now been deployed in freight ships in Greece that send telehealth cases to the Red Cross, and we actually have to have a Greek version of the system in a couple months. It's used in the prison systems in Panama to do consultations to prisoners. It's now being deployed actually in some homes in the United States for people that want to actually have health delivered to their bedroom, because the system, again, is easy enough to use and they can do the imaging. And we're looking at some contracts with cruise ships to make this available for the cruise industry. So it's really not just about delivering care to the village clinic. It's really a much bigger picture, but the same technology and I think the same models apply on a much bigger scale.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As I recall, I think it was at a Penoir conference several years ago, there were people from Canada talking about that their effort was to actually try to have care in home and be doing, and they didn't say specifically telehealth, but that's what I'm assuming they must have been saying. And sort of to that point is, and you mentioned it, but how far away might we be, and how possible is it that we could, for instance, have seniors who are maybe in the latter stages of their some kind of chronic disease or that kind of thing, and have telehealth in their home? Is that realistic? Is it something that could happen?
Through the chair to Representative Sisna. There are pieces of that happening right now. And even happening in Alaska. The Alaska Federal Healthcare Partnership has a home telehealth project, and Search may actually have something going too, where we're able to take, and it's mostly with elders, and it's people with congestive heart failure or other chronic disease management problems, where we can monitor those patients. And it's not unusual for a single nurse to be able to monitor between 50 and 300 patients on a daily basis. And there are preset alarms if the weight shifts or the blood pressure shifts, that then you can do an intervention. So the Federal Healthcare Partnership has, a plan to get about 300 homes throughout Alaska hooked up through this system. That is the largest growing aspect of telehealth worldwide, is home telehealth, and Canadians are actually heavily invested in that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you. So what would the cost savings, any idea what we're talking about? Because the intensive care unit at the hospital is extraordinarily expensive. Would that be a good alternative, almost like a hospice, but a kind of a super hospice in a way?
Right. Through the chair. Do I have to keep saying through the chair every time? I'm not sure of the protocol.
That's what they do around here.
All right, sorry. Through the chair, Representative Sisna. The home telehealth model is built on managing costs, not built on reimbursement. So exactly what you're talking about. Hospital visits and ER visits are extremely expensive, and avoiding one ER visit typically pay for the technology that's put into the patient's home. So any managed care system typically can benefit from that. Any payer typically that's paying for those visits is very interested in using that technology. And there are employee-based health plans that are now, when they have patients that have certain disease states, chronic disease states, they are requiring those patients to be monitored in their home, or they can't be eligible for benefits. So there is a shift kind of in this direction of trying to monitor the patient.
Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you, too, for showing up, and it's very encouraging to hear. So the reimbursement issue is something I think we're going to have to try to figure out. One of the questions we'll have to ask ourselves, is it federal rules that give us that problem? Is it our own state Medicaid health plan? Are they capital issues, or are they our payment issues? Can you help me just get a context to that?
Specific to the idea of trying to reimburse people for creating cases. There is a HCPCS code, if you're familiar with that. It's a level 2 HCPCS code that allows for the origination of a telehealth encounter. It's called a Q3014. That actually is reimbursed by Medicare, but typically it's used for somebody that's actually presenting somebody for a video conferencing session. What we're proposing is the same code, which is not really specific just to video, could be used in Alaska as the code if there was a fee schedule set to reimburse somebody for using the technology to create a telehealth case. I don't want to leave you with the impression that nobody gets paid when they do any of this at the village level. If you are doing a procedure that's funded, for instance, when you're capturing images of the retina, that procedure has a fee schedule associated with it. But to create a telehealth case means packaging that information and adding additional information and sending it. That's what takes time.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd be open to further information. I think there are things that we can do under the Medicaid rules that you may not be able to have so easily work under the Medicare rules. And it would be interesting to sit down and talk to our own people. I think there's flexibilities, put it that way. And the thing that is required, I think, is how we describe it in what we call our health plan that we submit to the centers, the CMS people. So that might be something that we could work on in Alaska, and I think that's something we should talk about.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess a comment and then a question, but obviously the big champion of Afghan carts was Senator Ted Stevens. Any comment on that?
No, he was actually phenomenally supportive of this. We're now continue to be funded through Indian Health Service, and Indian Health Service is actually budgeting additional funds to my office actually to develop the interface to their electronic health record with the intention that we can actually deploy this on a larger scale. That being said, it's been an interesting evolution. Last year, Native corporations in Alaska spent over $1 million of their own cash to buy additional technologies and support from my office. So we're beginning to see that people are actually investing their funds as opposed to relying on federal funds to grow and build the system. We just received a fairly large contract from Indian Health Service to build out an HIV/AIDS program to about 25 or 30 sites in the Southwest. So there's a lot of potential here. I think we're only now beginning to see where this is going to go.
Okay, I guess now to my question, and then if there's no other questions, we'll conclude the presentation and the meeting today. But okay, so this committee, of course, deals with policy issues for the state and for its residents in the state. Some of us are part of the budget subcommittee that relates to the Department of Health and Social Services. So I guess my question to you is what does the state need to do? What does the department need to do? What do legislators need to do to enhance this, to further this along in the short term, if you could answer that? Please.
Do you want to go?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there are a couple things. I think if we step away from telehealth and look a little bit more broadly at what's happening here, this is a communication technology. We're moving healthcare data to deliver care. We're doing this because we don't have any other system that does it, frankly. There's a huge initiative, and I think the state's being asked to help fund it, in terms of electronic health records. When electronic health records can capture and store this data and move it where it needs to go, we don't need this system. That would be in there. So I think when I think about the bigger picture, 10, 15 years out, supporting electronic health record initiatives is a key piece to this. On the shorter term, that's not going to happen very fast. And so we need to push telehealth technologies. It works very well, and it's funded in the federal sector. But I think the trick is, how can we take advantage of this in more of a public health scale and a broader scale in the state? The reimbursement issue is a key to that. I think thinking through what the business model and how you incentivize people to use this system is very important. And then that brings up all the other operational aspects, how you support and you train. It's not really a technology or equipment issue. You don't need a lot of equipment to do this. It's really the operational aspects and the business aspects that I think need to be addressed.
Mr. Chairman, on that point?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So I understand that we are moving down the road of electronic records and that we're ramping up a systems approach to it in our own Medicaid world, at least. And so we're probably 3 years out of landing on our feet on being able to move rapidly. The question is, are we doing the right kind of language that you can pick up on later on as far as the communication style or the backbone to the records? Have you seen anything?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, CERT, it's just a little bit different. We're already into electronic records. We just, our emergency department has gone electronic, soon to be followed by our primary care and the hospital later this year. And the behavioral health records will be electronic in March. Mm-hmm. So the
question, Mr. Chairman, is, with those who are going to be Medicaid billable, and as we begin to expand out, are we going to be able to do it in concert with you, or are we working at different speeds and in different venues?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. And as the case with CERT, specifically with behavioral health, I can speak to, we are designing our behavioral health package so that it will meet the requirements for the AK AIMS, and we are going to be building an interface with our system to match your system.
That's the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
I guess most of the legislators here at the table are multi-term. I mean, they've been around myself and Representative Keller were relatively new as being legislators, and so, but we're all two-year wonders here, and so we're literally, we're into instant gratification. So let's go to stimulus here. And so what is related to telemedicine, can you share with us is what you know that may help SEARCH's organization, but more importantly, telemedicine in the whole? Is there something in the stimulus that that we should give the department a heads up on as related? Are you aware of anything that's in the package that we should pay particular attention to?
Okay. I'll be honest, I'm not aware of anything specific in the stimulus package that's kind of slated towards telehealth. I know nationally the stimulus package has potentially hundreds of millions to billions that are slated for health information technology, and it's very unclear to all of us in the telehealth community how much of that is really going to come to telehealth versus something different in health information technology. And there's a big difference between those two. I mean, health information technology is a very broad concept, and telehealth is a very kind of focused portion of HIT. I'll be honest. The only communication I've been having lately is with Indian Health Service to see if some of that $85 million for health information technology is going into telehealth. And it's, as I understand it right now, it's really all being put into health record systems, and none of it is being focused on telehealth that I'm aware of at this point.
Yeah, it seems like what you said, I'll say it in a different way, is that all that stimulus money about health information delivery systems or health network systems, that's like having a phone line where Alaska, we already got T1. I mean we're actually way ahead of the power curve here. So,
yep.
Any other comments or questions? Yes, Representative Keller.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for coming. I mean, we 2 years ago, we were through your facility, and I'm delighted to see the growth. And it's already been said, but we're here to, you know, to help smooth the way so that all the efforts come together so that your records are interchangeable and they're all interchangeable. Just thank you. You talked about the 6-minute response on the doctor's end. Is that because of the reimbursement model? It's easier for them to be reimbursed than it is the creator of the health record. Am I understanding that right? Or what is that 6 minutes? What incentivizes that? I mean, that's a great response time.
Yeah, it is, and it's really related to the fact that it's a problem focused consultation. They get the information packaged, and when people are trained to give them the information, to give them the images, and to give them the relevant history, they can respond fairly fast to that. I don't think the 6 minutes is driven by the reimbursement. They get reimbursed, yep. But I think that's just an indication of how fast they can close a case out.
It's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, we were quite surprised, actually, at that data.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Well, I appreciate for all the committee members, I appreciate the presentation. Melody and to Dr. Fitzgerald, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's a little housekeeping here. Is our next meeting is the 26th, Thursday, and the agenda is House Bill 2, Birth of a Stillborn, and House Bill 26, Adult Dental Medicaid Program, and Representative Keller will be chairing that meeting. We are adjourned at 4:20.